Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Sholin Boysen. Sholin, we haven't had you on for a while. Good to see you back. How are you doing? I know you're busy, very busy with exams right now.
Yeah, Nick, I'm finally happy to be back on the show. You know, it's my favorite thing about being at the RR. So yeah, excited for the episode.
Awesome stuff. And of course, we also have one of our newer faces, Martin van Staden. Martin, how are you doing?
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. I'm getting excited to get into the very interesting news items that have happened over the last 24 hours.
Indeed. Now, we're not going to talk. We did talk a little bit about the United States midterms yesterday. We're not going to do that today because there's actually been very few results coming through. So I think our analysis is still pretty current. But before we get into the news stories, let me just quickly remind everyone that the IRR is coming to KZN next week on the 16th and 17th of November. On the 16th of November, we will be near Howick, where we will be having a meetup with friends of the Institute, friends of the IRR, friends of the Daily Friend, curious people who want to hear us maybe give a talk on the country and where we think it stands at 6 o'clock in the tap room at the Midlands Fable on 85 Curry's Post Road, north of Howick. And then we'll be in Umhlanga on the 17th of November at 6 o'clock at the corner of Aurora and Centenary Boulevard, Umhlanga, in the meeting room Floors 1 and 2. So you can come and check us out there. Our CEO, John Endres, will be there. Right. So let's get started with the news. And this is a statement that's been put out by the South African Human Rights Commission. Now, this is an organization which I have very mixed feelings on. I'm not super keen on some of the sort of Chapter 9 institutions as a rule. But, you know, nonetheless, I think it's quite, they can sometimes do good things, but they also often do things that I think are very silly or very wasteful. However, they've done something quite interesting, which I must say my perhaps overly prejudiced mind didn't think that they would do, which is that they've attacked the EFF for comments that Julius Malema recently made at a party gathering. So the South African Human Rights Commission says certain parts of Mr. Malema's speech on the 16th of October and some of the posters and banners displayed at the EFF event individually and collectively constitute incitement of violence, hate speech, and the possibility of other transgressions of the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act. Quote, if Malema and EFF do not within 10 days hereof appropriately retract and apologize for the prima facie unlawful statements in question and give appropriate undertakings to desist from further promotion of hatred and violence on any ground, the commission will proceed to the Equality Court for the appropriate interim interdictory relief. Well, in a case like this, you know, as liberals, we're not super keen on people facing some sort of legal action for speech for most of the time, but let's read specifically what statements they had a problem with. So in reference to an incident at the Brackenfell High School last year and a footage of a white person reportedly beating up an EFF member, Mr. Malema questioned why that white person had not been located and taken to, quote, an isolated place and attend to the guy properly, followed by an exhortation to members that you must never be scared to kill. A revolutionary act demands that at some point there must be killing because the killing is part of a revolutionary act. Malema went on to say, why did Mandela take up a gun? He was the first soldier of Mkhonto Sizwe to distribute. Was he the first soldier of Mkhonto Sizwe to distribute roses? He took up a gun because the revolution had reached a point where there was no longer an alternative but to kill. Anything that stands in the way of the revolution must be eliminated. Revolutionaries, when confronted by that situation, will not think twice. The EFF must be known that it is not a playground for racists and that any racist that plays next to the EFF and threatens and beats up the membership and leadership of the EFF, that is an application to meet your maker with immediate effect. Violence can only be ended with violence, not by any other necessary means. This is a war between white supremacy and black consciousness. You must know the two will never meet. We are in permanent war with white supremacists. So that sounds quite a lot like the Human Rights Commission may have a point, that there's some incitement going on over here. The EFF responded to this letter by saying, the EFF categorizes them as part of a nefarious attempt to erase the truth of our liberation history and an attempt to limit free speech due to its poor comprehension and misinterpretation of the political speech. Jolin, what do you make of this case?
Yeah, no, Nick, I definitely think that this is an important announcement by the Human Rights Commission, especially when it comes to a public figure like Malema. I think we know that he has a lot of influence, and for him to recklessly make statements of violence, you know, calling for murder, and this is not the first time. Previously, we know he's made statements like kill the poor, which is, in my view, literally calling for genocide. And I think that, you know what, there needs to be opposition to when he says things like this, whether it's legal or whether it's just like we are doing right now publicly in the public sphere. There needs to be opposition nonetheless. And I also think a key note that we need to listen to what Malema is saying here is that he's clearly communicating the process that takes place to advance his political party's agenda. The EFF, as we know, is a clearly, you know, it's a Marxist organization that forms the basis of what we have globally seen as communism. And what we have seen throughout history across the world, this is not a uniquely South African thing, is that when these communist ideas, you know, do not bring forth or do not succeed in bringing this utopian idea that they promise and that the political leaders promise, the only way that they know that they have to advance this revolution, as Malema says it, is that they know that they need to make use of violence. And that is clearly what he is admitting here, is that he understands that the ideas, the execution of these ideas is not already going to be sustainable enough. And therefore, he needs to follow the lead of these historical Marxist figures. And, you know, eventually it will require them to take up arms to force and to coerce the public into accepting the ideas. That is a great admission that I don't think we should take lightly from Malema, is for him to admit that, you know what, our ideas are not that great, but therefore we need to take up arms and we need to act violently to force our ideas. And that should say a lot about the value of that, of the ideas, I think, in the public space, Nick.
So, Martin, how, you know, I don't, how strong, just based off of what you've heard here, how strong a case do you think the Human Rights Commission might have that this is some sort of incitement? You know, Malema is clearly, at least in part in some of these comments, will claim that, oh no, well, I was just talking about historical examples. I was just talking about being defensive and practicing self-defense from, you know, these white thugs who are coming to beat our members up, something like that. What do you make of these comments and the potential case that maybe, because I doubt the EFF will retract these statements.
Yeah, look, I think that there is, when you talk about the Equality Court, which is where the Human Rights Commission would take the case, there is a little bit of a confidence deficit there after the recent AfriForum case against Malema, where Malema sat in the witness stand and he actually told the judge, yes, a revolutionary is a cold-blooded killing machine. He said he will not retract the singing of Kill the Boer. He said he will not retract his statement that they're not calling for the slaughter of white people just yet, but he might. He actually said he might do it in the future. He can't guarantee that he might not do it. And even then, the Equality Court said, no, actually, this is protected speech. So I'm not. I don't think. I think the case here is even weaker than what AfriForum had. So I don't think this case has a lot of potential for success, but I think nonetheless, it's a good indication that the Human Rights Commission is starting to shift a little bit, because you'll remember that the Human Rights Commission a few years ago, in another Malema case, said that, well, you have to actually take into account the fact that Julius Malema is black, and the fact that he says these things means that it's not really hate speech. But if a white person were to say it, then it would be hate speech. That's the Human Rights Commission who said that. Now, I think after the AfriForum case and more rhetoric from Malema, the Human Rights Commission has reached a point where they're like, how would the history books record the South African Human Rights Commission when this guy becomes the president and he starts killing people and throwing them in camps and so on? How would they think about us? And I think they've come to the conclusion, yeah, we need to edge over to the right side of that history book. So I think that in itself is a good indication. But more than that, it's always good when Malema says these things, because it does show us what to expect when the EFF gets access to the levers of power, either directly or through a coalition agreement. Now, I'm a big fan of Godwin's law, so excuse me for invoking it. The National Socialists in Germany came to power through a coalition agreement initially, and through that expanded their hold on the levers of power in that country, becoming a totalitarian dictatorship. So don't think that even if the EFF is a minority member of a government coalition, that it would be kept in check. I don't think being kept in check is part of the EFF's DNA. So that's why it's so important in the next election and in future elections for the United Opposition not to only focus on criticizing the ANC, getting it under 50%, but getting the ANC and the EFF and some of the other gaggle of parties collectively under 50%. Because as Ayn Rand, I think it's her term, her phase, once said that you can easily vote your way into socialism, but you will certainly have to shoot your way out of socialism. If the EFF is in power, we're not going to vote it out. I can sit here today and say that it will not accept defeat in a national election. It simply will not happen. So we basically have one chance. If it's in power, then things get spicy. But for as long as it's out of power, there's a lot of potential. And the more Malema says these things like, standing in the way of revolution, one must kill when people stand in the way of the revolution. It's clear that he is equating his politics, his ordinary socialist backwards politics, with something as integral as a revolution. And if you stand against me, as Sholin said, if you don't agree with my politics, hey, I'm going to kill you. It's as simple as that. So this is a great red flag. It's a great warning to South Africans, to voters, that, we need to withhold votes specifically from the EFF. Even if you still want to vote ANC, that's terrible, but vote for them rather than voting for the Red Berets, because that really is a death sentence for South Africa's democracy and for the potential for prosperity, for economic growth, for liberty itself. All of those things fall away when you put people like this in power.
Right. I think the third statement that the South African Human Rights Commission, as you say, highlighted, which is that anything that stands in the way of the revolution must be eliminated, is possibly the most illiberal statement that you can possibly make. Something not to be taken lightly, as I think very often both the ANC and EFF are. They often say in their policy documents very explicitly what they believe, what they want to achieve, and how they're going to get there. And for some reason, a lot of commentators just don't take them seriously. They say, oh, it's just rhetoric. Well, it's just rhetoric until it's not. I think it's very something to very much keep in mind. Okay. Let us move on to the next story. And of course, this is, I think, connected to what we just talked about. And this is a poll by the Rivonia Circle. So the Rivonia Circle have been touted as kind of a group that they're opposed to the ANC, but they're also not quite on board with the other opposition parties. There's some talk that maybe some from them, there may come some kind of political movement. But we haven't seen, I think, a huge amount of evidence of that so far. However, they have put out what they say is a representative survey, polling people of the country on how they feel about politics. So they did this poll and they found that no party, according to their poll, would get 50% of the vote, or at least has 50% of voters behind it. So what's the question asked was, the next South African general election would be held in May 2024. If that election was today, who would you be casting your vote for? 41% said the ANC, 18% said the DA, 15% said the EFF, which is a slightly better poll number than they've had in a while, but still not great. 5% said the IFP, 1% said the Freedom Front Plus, 6% said Action SA. And I think this is interesting for interpreting this part of the poll, that this poll is 13% said don't know. So their takeaway, their spin on these poll results was that while people aren't super keen to vote for the ANC, this doesn't mean the opposition is picking up a lot of votes. And that the implication here is that there needs to be some either a drastic change in the way that current opposition parties operate, or alternatively, a new opposition party. Martin, let me start with you. I think when interpreting this poll, one of the things that is a little bit unhelpful is the large number of people who say they don't know, or they refuse to answer the question when asked who they're going to vote for. I think that if you apply what's called a likely voter screen, or a sort of confirmed voter screen, something like that, to this poll, and you try to pressure people into working out precisely whether they will vote, firstly, and secondly, who they would vote for if they are likely to vote, you would probably see something that benefits the opposition a bit and hurts the ANC even more. Although I can't be sure of that. I'm not a pollster. What do you make of these results, and what do you think it says about the place we're currently at in the political system?
Yeah, so I'm also not qualified to interpret these polls on any type of academic level, so I can just shoot from the hip, as it were. And I think that 13% don't know is an important one. So it seems like this poll still proceeds from the assumption that going forward, South Africa is a dominant party state, when I think our analysis, at least from the Institute, has been that that's rapidly changing. In the last general election, in the last municipal election, the small parties just exploded in support. I think small parties collectively doubled their support as a collective from the previous election, or even more than that. So that, to me, is an indication of a very clear paradigm shift in South African politics. And going into these polls and assuming that it's going to be the ANC, DA, EFF, and the other smaller big parties, I think that's a fundamental mistake. That 13% of don't knows is probably going to, I can't say probably or not probably, but it's not outside the realm of possibility that they will again distribute their votes amongst a bunch of smaller parties, hopefully, which are part of the wild dog anti-EFF ANC coalition. What does worry me, of course, from what I just said, is that it seems like the EFF still has growth potential. That's always going to be quite concerning to me. The big risk in the 2024 election is that the ANC gets pushed under 50%, but not enough so, and that it would feel compelled to enter into a coalition agreement with the EFF, which stands to make, that could make 2024 the last democratic election in South Africa's history, which would be bad. So one hopes that the EFF support is overestimated. But then again, I think the point they make about the current opposition not being good enough is probably true, because you don't see the type of campaigning specifically against the EFF that you would want to see from specifically the DA, but also, I mean, something like the Freedom Front Plus. You would imagine they would spend all of their time going against this radically, I would call it genocidal political party. But that's not happening, because I think everyone's focused too much, other than the infighting between the wild dogs, on the ANC, and they're missing this very crucial piece of the post-2024 puzzle, and that is the EFF. And I think there's easy campaigns to take against the EFF on what they've done, the VBS deal. They were also the biggest proponent of a strict lockdown during COVID-19, which cost millions of people their jobs and businesses. But none of these things are being thrown at their feet. So I do agree a little bit there with the Rivonia circle that it seems like the current opposition parties don't really offer too much of an alternative. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. I've been pretty keen on the DA's more radically federalist positions recently, and I hope they double down on that in a very real way to make themselves out as a real a radical, almost call it opposition to radically bad ideas. So the EFF's growth worries me, but as I said, I think that the small parties are probably going to surprise us again in 2024 in how much support they get collectively.
I'm interested in, so based off of this poll and how I interpret that sort of large percentage of people saying they don't know, And based on this, the second finding of this poll, which is that eligible voters are disillusioned with current political leaders and political parties, whose respondents believe, are unethical, dishonest, and do not deliver on promises made. And this was disillusionment not just with the ANC, but with pretty much every political party and politician. I suspect, and Sheldon, tell me if you agree with me here, that our next election, there's sort of two ways it could go, right? There's one way where people sense that we're at a moment of great political change, and as a result, huge numbers of people come out and vote. But I have a feeling that the more likely scenario might be a little bit what we saw in the last municipal election, which is that people are so disillusioned with everything that it really becomes a turnout game, and that this turnout game will hurt the ANC the most and possibly see a Wild Hogs coalition getting a majority, because I think their voters, while not super enthusiastic, are probably more enthusiastic than ANC voters to go out and vote. And that, what they call disproportional turnout, will favor, generally speaking, the opposition. But I don't know. What do you think, Sheldon?
Definitely, as Martin was speaking, the immediate thought that was coming to my mind was that much of the discussion, especially like with the pollsters, is that they tend to approach people that, you know, are like possibly engaged, who are registered voters. You know, these are people that are, that actually care about the political party or political figure. But what is actually concerning to me is that there is this large group, and I think there's actually a figure given in the article. Nick, I just can't remember the exact figure.
Right. It's 28 million or something people in the country who are eligible but not registered to vote. And the Rivonia Circle says that they are trying to register 500,000 people before the next election because they think that not enough people are politically involved. But it's correct to say that the last couple of elections, the didn't vote at all chunk of the electorate of eligible adults, of presumably politically people who could potentially be politically engaged, they're by far the largest group, much bigger even than the ANC.
Yeah, and for various amounts of reasons, a lot of the political figures and political parties that are currently there right now are so focused on, as Martin mentioned, you know, it's internal squabbles between people who could potentially be your coalition partners. Inside the party, there might be divisions, and they're also trying to solidify the support that they have right now, that I don't think enough attention is being given to this large amount of more than 20 million, if I remember correctly just now, Nick, of non-registered voters who are eligible to vote for your political party that can be engaged. I understand, of course, that, you know, there are limitations. There might be financial limitations for these political parties, you know, when it comes to campaigning and so forth. But I think that that is a much greater opportunity to, you know, reach these people. And it is a difficult task. I won't take that away. Gaining electoral support from people who are disengaged, who are still trying to make up their mind of, you know, who do I actually want to support, then trying to, as we've seen with some political parties, trying to steal from the already established base from another, you know, opponent or already established political party. So I do think that, you know, political figures, you know, analysts, you know, the strategists in these political parties really need to start giving attention to this group of disengaged voters who are frustrated, who are, I mean, everyone is really, you know, angry and frustrated with the current political situation, the economic situation of this country. That is a crucial tool that you can bait these individuals into the political discourse. And that's why I think that those are the people that need, that require a lot of attention if we are to succeed in, you know, bringing about an alternative to the current ANC EFF side of the political spectrum. And that's why I think that is a crucial target, Nick.
I think that's really the big question of South African politics at the moment is there anyone who can activate those non-voters? Maybe there are. Maybe you don't even necessarily need them, although that's, I think, a difficult road to speak, travel. But if a political party, either a current one or one that is yet to emerge, could activate a large number of those people who didn't vote and encourage them to come out, they would become, I think, in many ways, the most powerful political force in the country. Whether anyone can do it or not is an open question, but I think that opportunity is being noticed by various groups, and I suspect the sort of Rivonia people and some of the people around it, the Rivonia circle and some of the people around it might say, you know, maybe we can do that. I'm sure Musi Maimane's party is going to definitely also try for that space. And I suspect, but before 2024, there's going to be a whole bunch of other people who try their luck, some more seriously, some less seriously. But yeah, I really think that we've kind of got open goals here, and it's not clear which side is going to score. Because if those voters are activated, it will change our dynamics, I think, very fundamentally. Okay. So let's go on to our last story, and we've kind of been following this one on and off on the show over the last couple of months, but it looks like a court ruling has allowed that Amazon headquarters, which is going to be built on a what was formerly, I think, a disused golf course in Cape Town, to go ahead, and Amazon can continue its construction of its new African headquarters. This was after there was originally a blocking of the construction. When a group calling itself a sort of indigenous people's group, as well as some members of the local residents association from, I think, the Observatory Residents Association, sort of teamed up together to stop the thing in court. However, things got more complicated when a second indigenous people's group emerged and said that the first group, which was against the development, did not actually represent the community that it claimed to, and that they were the real representatives and they were behind the development. Which caused quite a lot of drama in court. But it seems now that the court has given at least the go-ahead for the High Court concluded that a representative for several groups opposing the construction had, quote, misrepresented the views of some Indigenous leaders without consulting them. The campaigners say they're deeply disappointed at the ruling, and I'm sure are going to continue to fight it as much as they can, but it looks like, at least for now, that Amazon has a leg up in this dispute. Martin, what do you make of this?
To me, it's one of the classic case studies of why a liberal approach to policy must rationally be adopted. Because what we have here is a great case of the tragedy of the commons. There's this piece of property that's owned by, I think it's Cape Town, probably the municipality. And they've decided over the course of its history to lease it out to a golf course. Building a golf course over ancestral lands to me seems to be as much of a desecration as building a corporate headquarters there. So I'm not sure precisely why the golf course was okay, but this isn't. But that being as it may, it should be private property, because then if the indigenous group felt very strongly about that, they could have pooled resources, bought it, and then built what I think they're suggesting, a type of community center and a museum and stuff like that run by the community. And that's great. And I think they should certainly do that if they
Amazon has offered also some kind of similar concession where they say they will build like a historical memorial walk and stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, you see there, but the fact is, for as long as these things, and I'm not sure if the municipality is now selling it to Amazon or leasing it, I think it's probably a lease, it just kicks the problem down the road again, where this property is always going to be a matter of political dispute, when the historically liberal answer is, listen, we have people getting the pre-political form into wars about who gets to control property, and then later politics, which is another form of war. And our answer is simple. The property needs to be owned by an owner, and what the owner says goes. And that's the simple liberal answer for the avoidance of conflict. Otherwise, in our current system, you're going to have continuous litigation about this property forevermore. When Amazon is done, or when they want to sublease or whatever, we're going to have another fresh round of litigation. And that's simply not what a property respecting society should look like. It creates massive uncertainty, especially in light of the fact that this is the type of arrangement that this government and many of its allies, including the EFF, wants to extend across all property in South Africa. They want everything to become a matter of political dispute, whether a property is, when would it be used in a legitimate fashion, a minister will need to determine, or the courts would need to determine, when in fact the owner should determine. So yeah, when I read about this stuff, about litigation, about who gets to decide about the property, it just it's such a clear manifestation again for me that we need to reconsider our approach to property rights entirely and say, listen, the answer has been found. Private property. We need to privatize all of these commons, these things that we say belongs to everyone in a very nebulous sense, because then we can avoid disputes like this. People who have an interest in property can buy that property and they can use it however they want and not litigate, not spend massive amounts of court time, public taxpayer money on fighting these cases continuously. So yes, we know the answer. We know how this problem is rationally solved, and I hope we can do a good job of convincing other South Africans of that as well.
Sherlyn, very briefly, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, Nick. All I wanted to say was that I am all for preserving heritage and respecting what our history. I think that's important. But I think there should also be a discussion had about whether or not that should come at the expense of much needed investment and job creation in this regard. What I would say is that what is concerning for me though is that we have the situation where there's this group of activists who appear to have ulterior motives, who seem to hijack the discussion, the process for their own gains, for their own personal gains, or whatever social status they think they will gain from, being these pioneers. And this also reminds me of a similar thing with the Sal situation, where Sal was also stopped from, the exploration or whatever. And I think that whether it's justified or not, I think that's open for discussion. But I do think that it is a hindrance for other, companies who have these major investments that can actually be very, very, very useful when we are trying to tackle things like poverty or inequality, things that these activists claim to be very concerned about as well. So I'm like, we need to also be considered that there are people watching and these things have greater consequences than just this one instance, Nick. Yeah.
No, definitely something to keep in mind. Okay, I think that is all the time we have for today for the Daily French Show. We hope that you found it interesting. I actually wrote an article on the EFF ANC coalition potential, which I think is coming out on the dailyfriend.co.za on Saturday. So if you're interested in that, please keep an eye out for that. But otherwise, cheers, everyone, and we'll see you next week on the Daily Friend Show. Bye, everyone.